From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Internet is back on in North Korea. The United Nations looks at North Korea's human rights record. Ukraine takes a step toward NATO membership. The leader of New York City's police union is critical of remarks by the city's mayor. It's all ahead. I'm Dave DeForest. North Korea has regained partial internet access following a widespread outage. North Korea's internet, including state-run news websites, went completely dark late Monday in what experts say appears to be the result of a cyber attack. The outage lasted for about 9 hours before several websites came back online early Tuesday, including the Korean Central News Agency and the Rondong Simbun newspaper. The internet monitoring company, Dyn Research, said the North's four online networks have been fully restored. The U.S.-based group said the reason for the outage is not clear, but is consistent with a fragile network under external attack. Just days ago, President Barack Obama warned the U.S. would retaliate for what Washington says is North Korea's hacking of Sony Pictures. A State Department spokeswoman, when asked about the situation, declined comment. However, she said the United States government is discussing a range of options in response to the Sony hacking, some of which, she said, will be seen and some may not be seen. In South Korea, there are voices of support for the idea that U.S. President Barack Obama might put North Korea back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism in response to the cyber attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment. But as VOA's Brian Patton reports from Seoul, there are also voices urging restraint.
South Korea has its own history with alleged North Korean cyber attacks. In the last 5 years, South Korean officials have accused North Korea of hacking into banks, government websites, and broadcasters, causing chaos and costing millions of dollars in damages. Perhaps the most infamous incident was a 2013 cyber attack known as Dark Seoul that virtually shut down three South Korean television stations and a bank, as well as affiliated ATMs and mobile payment plans. Korean studies professor Andre Lankoff at Cookman University says the recent cyber attack against Sony Pictures in the United States does not make North Korea suddenly more dangerous, but it is raising the perceived threat level.
Threat level, no. Perceived threat level, yes. Because it's a usual problem of the Americans. When something is happening outside the American shores, it's happening. And when America itself is targeted, they began to take it far more seriously.
The hacker cyber attack on Sony Corporation and threats of violence against theaters led to the cancellation of the release of the comedy movie The Interview that depicts the fictional assassination of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Bo Hyung-wook, an analyst at the Korea Institute for Defense Analysis, however, says the Sony cyber attack demonstrates an ongoing increasing threat that so far is not being taken seriously enough by South Korea and the U.S. North Korea, he says, is enhancing its cyber attack capability while their readiness posture against cyber attack is weak. He says North Korea has trained over 3,000 cyber experts to spy on and attack foreign networks. The North Korean government has denied it was involved in the attacks and has threatened to strike back if the U.S. retaliates. President Obama has promised a proportional response and is considering putting North Korea back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism, a move that would limit aid, defense exports, and certain financial transactions. In 2008, U.S. President George W. Bush removed North Korea from that list as part of negotiations to end Pyongyang's nuclear program. Bo Hyung-wook says North Korea should already be back on the list for breaking past promises to curb its nuclear program. He says it is obvious that North Korea should be added to the list of terror-sponsoring countries as it proliferates weapons of mass destruction around the world and supports the delivery of weapons to terror groups. but Lankoff says imposing new economic restrictions on top of existing U.S. sanctions in place on North Korea for violating its nuclear agreements will have little impact.
The U.S. has already implemented a lot of sanctions with zero results. Well, it's possible to implement more sanctions with same result, that is, no result.
He is more in agreement with President Obama's description of the alleged North Korea hacking episode as a case of cyber vandalism, not an act of war. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
In an unprecedented move, 11 of 15 UN Security Council members Monday voted in support of putting North Korea's human rights record on its agenda, despite objections from Russia and China. The procedural vote is not subject to a veto by any of the five permanent council members. George Scarlatoy, the executive director of the non-governmental organization Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, told VOA's Victor Beatty the Security Council vote Monday is significant.
This is the first time ever that North Korean human rights issues are discussed at the Security Council. Of course, this spring we had an informal area formula meeting. It is very important that 11 out of 15 permanent and non-permanent members of the UN Security Council voted in favor of including North Korean human rights in the Security Council's agenda. We are fully aware of the opposition of China and Russia that was to be expected. They voted no. Certainly, now that the issue is on the agenda, should it be taken up in the near future, it will no longer be a procedural matter, but a substantive matter, subject to a veto by one of the P5, one of the permanent members, and certainly the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation are permanent members. Nevertheless, casting a veto is not a very easy thing to do, and there is a certain political price associated with casting a veto in order to stop action aimed to address crimes against humanity being committed in North Korea.
China's UN ambassador said the Security Council is not the forum to get involved in human rights issues and should refrain from doing anything that might cause an escalation.
I would say that the matter being discussed here is not escalation. The matter being discussed here is crimes against humanity. We have had an excellent report produced by the UN Commission of Inquiry. One of the key findings of that report is that crimes against humanity may have been committed in North Korea. As recommended by the UN Special Rapporteur Marzuki Darusman, former Attorney General of Indonesia, we should follow a two-track approach. On the one hand, we should continue to pursue strong accountability measures. On the other hand, we can still continue to pursue technical assistance. First and foremost, a visit by the UN Special Rapporteur and why not the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Prince Zayed. Such visits are long overdue. After all, we've had a UN Special Rapporteur for 10 years. The Special Rapporteur has not yet been able to visit North Korea.
Greg Scarlatoy is the Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty. Ukraine took a further step towards seeking NATO membership today when the country's parliament passed a law abolishing Kiev's neutral, non-aligned status. Lawmakers voted overwhelmingly to do away with a non-aligned status. It was adopted in 2010 under Russian pressure and prevented Ukraine from making military alliances. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has said he will seek membership in NATO, the Western Military Alliance, as his government fights Russian-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine. I'm Dave DeForest on The Voice of America, and this is International Edition.
Katy Perry, Beyoncé, Adele, Taylor Swift, just a few of the music celebrities we've interviewed on Border Crossings. Weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix. I'm Larry London. We also play your requests and have great prizes to give away. Join us for Border Crossings Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix.
New York Mayor Bill de Blasio and the head of the city's police union, Patrick Lynch, are trading criticism with each other as the city mourns the deaths of two policemen killed by a crazed shooter. The AP reports that Lynch says city officials, including the mayor, have, in his words, blood on their hands because of the shooting. De Blasio, who earlier this month issued statements in favor of recent protests against the police, called the remarks divisive. New York police officers Juan John Liu and Rafael Ramos were killed Saturday by Ishmael Brinsley, who had issued threats against police, referencing recent cases of white police officers killing unarmed black suspects. We get more on the story from Carolyn Weaver in New York.
Flowers, candles, and tributes continue to grow at the Brooklyn street corner where the two officers were fatally shot Saturday as they sat in their patrol car. Officers Wenjin Liu and Rafael Ramos died after Ishmael Brinsley opened fire through a car window. Brinsley, who had a history of violence and mental illness, then killed himself as police pursued him into a subway station. He had announced his plan to murder police earlier on social media to avenge the recent deaths of two unarmed black men at the hands of police. Speaking to a police youth group Monday, Mayor Bill de Blasio said recent protests sparked by the deaths, including Eric Garner's chokehold death in New York, should be put on hold for the time being.
I think it's a time for everyone to put aside political debates, put aside protests, put aside all of the things that we will talk about in due time. But in the coming days, two families prepare for funerals. Two families try to think about how to piece their lives back together. That should be our only concern.
The mayor and New York Police Commissioner William Bratton visited the families of the two dead men Monday. Bratton earlier said the killings were a direct spin-off from the protests, while a police union chief, Patrick Lynch, cast blame on the mayor for being sympathetic to the protesters' cause.
There's blood on many hands tonight. Those that incited violence on the street under the guise of protest, that blood on the hands starts on the steps of City Hall in the office of the mayor.
Anti-police brutality activists who also came to lay a wreath where the officers had fallen said they were just as outraged by the police deaths. Kirsten John Foy.
And we're going to stand with our police department, those that will stand with us. We're going to stand with this family. We're going to do everything we can to bring healing to this city in this time.
Funerals are being planned for the two dead men as family members of Officer Liu arranged to travel from China. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
11 people were injured too seriously when a man shouting the Islamic phrase "God is great" in Arabic drove his car into crowds of pedestrians Sunday in the French city of Dijon. Henry Ridgewell looks at the growing threat of the so-called lone wolf attacks, which security experts say are likely inspired by the terrorist group Islamic State.
Reports say the attacker in Dijon shouted Allah Akbar before ploughing his car into groups of pedestrians. Witnesses say he invoked the children of Palestine to explain his actions. France's Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve visited the injured in hospital.
Chacun sait en France que la menace est réelle. Il faut l'anticiper.
He said everyone in France knows the threat is real. It needs to be anticipated, to be countered, and that is what the police and intelligence services are doing every day. The attack occurred after a man stabbed and wounded three officers inside a police station Saturday in central France. He also shouted, "God is great." Jean-Luc Beck is the public prosecutor in Joux-les-Tours, where the attack happened.
Individu qui attaque un commissariat.
He said an individual who attacks a police station while shouting Allah Akbar gives rise to the question if he was acting alone or on orders. That is resonating across the Western world. Last week, three people were killed, including the gunman, when Iranian-born man Harun Monis took several people hostage in a cafe in Sydney, Australia. He had demanded an Islamic State flag, despite apparently having no traceable links to the terror group. The spectre of lone terrorists drawing inspiration from Islamic terrorists is a growing threat, says Sajan Gohel of the Asia-Pacific Foundation.
self-starters who have not traveled abroad, but nevertheless are galvanized by the ISIS narrative and its ideology. People that may not be part of the ISIS machinery, but are certainly adopting its ideology.
Intelligence services are also battling to contain the threat posed by their own nationals who travel to fight with Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Again, security analyst Sajjan Gohel.
Individuals from the West who have gone to Iraq and Syria, linked up with ISIS, taken part in battles and attacks, and then with the intention of coming home potentially to carry out terrorist attacks.
The European Union says more than 3,000 Europeans have travelled to the region. They are often not on the radar of security services, says French terror expert Jean-Charles Brissard.
We don't have any pattern or profile with these jihadists. And this is why it's difficult to identify them, to prevent them from travelling there. They're coming from all social classes.
Intelligence reports suggest many foreign fighters are disenchanted and want to return home, but are being forced to stay. Activists claim recently 100 foreigners had been executed for trying to flee the group. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Decrease in rubber imports by China and other countries is being partly blamed for a crisis in Southeast Asia's rubber industry. Prices have been falling below production costs, correspondent Steve Herman reports.
For rubber farmers in Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia, who supply two-thirds of the $36 billion annual market, this has been when their crop hit a dead bounce. Yum Tavarolit is the chief executive officer of the three-country International Rubber Consortium.
They are suffering from too low prices below cost of production because of the underprice from rubber futures or rubber exchanges.
Yum says that has forced some rubber farmers to put away their tapping knives.
They switch to other agricultural activities, some cutting down old rubber trees.
The consortium contends that speculators are skewing prices and that the ratio between supply and demand does not justify such low prices. But analysts contacted by VOA Monday say traders are taking a wait-and-see attitude because of a recent intervention in the market by Thailand's government under control of a military-led junta since a coup 7 months ago. Thailand is funding to the tune of nearly $2 billion. Programs that include purchasing rubber directly from producers is part of an $11 billion agriculture stimulus project. A key industry broker in Tokyo, who did not want to be named because of his company's business ties with the Thai rubber industry and government, says such market intervention by Thailand has always failed. What the Thai government actually needs to do, he tells VOA, is cut down rubber trees and control the supply. Otherwise, they will keep on producing rubber, and the government is buying rubber, but the global market cannot buy such expensive rubber. The global supply surplus for this year is estimated to total about 300,000 tons. But the CEO of the International Rubber Consortium says Thailand and other governments have no choice but to aid their rubber farmers.
Immediate assistance is necessary. For a longer term, there should be other sustainable measures to assist farmers to be more sustainable. But for the current situation, there is no choice for the Thai government to do whatever measures to help rubber farmers who are suffering.
In Japan, a five-year low for rubber was seen in early October. The Thai government's support helped temporarily to boost prices, but they have sagged again this month. China announced Friday it would double the volume of imports of agricultural products from Thailand next year, including rice and rubber. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Finally, also in Africa, the World Health Organization is saying the death toll from the Ebola outbreak has risen to more than 7,500 people. The number of cases is nearing 20,000. Well, that's it for International Edition today. You can get the latest breaking news, by the way, and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com. Again, today, sitting in for Susan Yaki, I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day. This is Today in History. On December 23, 1783, following the signing of the Treaty of Paris, which ended the American Revolutionary War, General George Washington resigned as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army and returned to Mount Vernon in Virginia. On this day in 1867, Sarah Breedlove, later known as Madam C.J. Walker, was born. The daughter of former slaves, Walker transformed herself from an uneducated farm laborer and laundress into one of the 20th century's most successful black businesswomen. She developed and marketed beauty and hair products for black women. In 1913, President Woodrow Wilson signed into law the Federal Reserve Act, creating the American Central Banking System, a network of regional banks responsible for regulating the nation's banking system. The act balanced the competing interests of private banks and populist sentiment. In 1933, Akihito, who became Japan's 125th emperor in 1990, was born. This day in 1947 was a defining moment in the history of electronic technology when a research team at Bell Telephone Laboratories held the first demonstration of the transistor. The transistor is considered one of the most important inventions of the 20th century. In 1948, General Hideki Tojo, former Japanese premier, along with six other senior Japanese leaders, was executed for war crimes committed during World War II. On this day in 1972, an estimated 10,000 people died after an earthquake devastated Managua, Nicaragua. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world's fisheries are a natural resource that provides employment for over 50 million people and food for billions. Despite the resource's great importance, though, its health and sustainability are increasingly under threat. Illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing is a major environmental problem and an economic challenge. The United States is committed to improving fisheries management, protecting the oceans, and safeguarding this marine bounty for generations to come. Toward this end, a special presidentially appointed task force on December 16th released recommendations for a framework for our nation to follow to combat illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing and seafood fraud. The goal is a more systematic, coordinated domestic approach and greater U.S. leadership internationally on these issues. The recommendations would apply equally to U.S. and foreign seafood. One focuses on our government engaging with international partners to strengthen fisheries management and enforcement around the globe. One important step is convincing more nations to join into the Port State Measures Agreement, a binding global instrument to combat illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. Another calls for a program to trace the sources of seafood brought to market. According to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a fisheries regulator, U.S. fishermen last year landed 9.9 billion pounds of fish and shellfish worth $5.5 billion. Globally, annual losses attributable to illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing have been estimated at $10 to $23 billion. These practices fuel trafficking operations while undermining economic opportunities for fishermen and seafood companies engaged in legal fishing. Vessels fishing in restricted waters or exceeding their limits gain an unfair advantage over law-abiding fishing operations. For example, some pay no licensing fees, denying governments needed revenues for protecting their resources. After a review period for public comment on implementation of the recommendations, the task force will develop an action plan. The United States will continue to work with partners around the world to promote the proper management of marine resources for the benefit of future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.